1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 166, Carnal Mysteries, readings by authors Terry Holland, Lisa Bickmore, Lorraine Wilkins, and Paul Swenson, chaired by Rachel Day. This is a 60-minute session taped on a 90-minute tape, so the second half of Side 2 will be blank.
I think we're about ready to get started, right? I guess so. Thanks, everyone, for coming. This session is Carnal Mysteries, so don't be alarmed if if you're not in the right place. Presenting today are four local poets. I think everyone is still living here. Paul Swenson, Lisa Bickmore, Lorraine Wilkins, and Terry Holland. Paul specifically requests to be introduced as a journalist whose heart is in poetry. And he's currently an editor at a new paper, the Salt Lake Observer, and says that the paper is accepting poetry submissions. So for closet or non-closet poets, send your stuff in, because he's looking for it. Let's see, other bio stuff. Lisa, you may have seen her book Haste, a collection of poems which... published by Signature, which she read from not last symposium, but the one before that. Lorraine says she plays the organ in church, which also inspires her writing. Terry has recently been published in the Paris Review and North American Review, so we have some distinguished credentials, and I think an interesting session ahead. So,
the story I wanted to read is Lost in Cyberspace. I know. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Well, actually, I can hear you better than I can hear you, but the mic is down.
I have recently recuperated from cancer, and I don't like to be told what to do anymore. Well, they won't let me do that either. My name is Terry Holland. I was going to read a really wonderful story to you. I can tell you that because I'm not going to read it. And this is somewhere. It's in someone's computer somewhere. So I'm going to read a couple short stories interspersed with some wonderful poetry. This story is entitled Desire. See if you know why. Her attention has wandered away somewhere. She lives in her varicose veins. She has a hard time locating her own thoughts. They tumble around inside her like stones in a river, smoothing out, then wearing away. Her life is a desert, and she has forgotten the light, and the darkness inside her has begun to feel like home. Still, she crumbles into bed at night with a head full of ache and a heart full of woe. She goes to see the doctor, the lawyer, the Indian chief, without success. Her husband, his hand on her life, tells her, "Rosemary," he says, "there isn't any more I can give you, and isn't it enough anyway?" She doesn't know she's even looking for it until she finds it. But it's lying face down in the intersection of Wildwood Drive and Yale, and though she's never seen it before, she recognizes it immediately. She picks it up and, shaking like a chihuahua, stows it on an old army blanket in the trunk of the Subaru. When she's home, she clears the jumble from the table and sets it down dead center. She marvels at it. She thinks herself lucky, lucky at last. She locks the door, closes the curtains. She caresses it. It's round and squat and dense. It's heavier than she expects and smoother. It vibrates a little, and when she draws close to it, she can almost make out a melody. Before her husband comes home, she hides it in the bedroom closet behind a pile of shoes. That night, Rosemary dreams herself as a little girl in a room surrounded by glass. Rosemary watches as the little girl runs her hand along the wall searching for a rupture, but it's solid and impenetrable. She is trapped and soon realizes she must break the glass to escape. She runs in tight circles, turning in on herself, gaining momentum before she hurls her body at the gleaming enclosure. Rosemary closes her eyes and listens as the child and barrier impact. Shards of glass rain around her, pieces embedding themselves in her hands and face and arms. Reluctantly, Rosemary opens her eyes. Glass is scattered everywhere at her feet, and the little girl is gone. Frantically, she scans the room and finds the wall surprisingly still intact. She's puzzled until she realizes it is the little girl that has shattered and not the wall of glass. Morning sends her husband away to work and she's alone. She opens the closet and there in the center of things is her small treasure. It sits near the back in the corner, devouring the entire contents of her closet. Even as she stares wide-eyed, it sucks up one navy high-heeled pump and then a running shoe like a black hole sucking the stars from the sky. Desperate and without thinking, she picks it up. It's lighter now and less thick, as if the more it consumes, the less it contains. She can't think what to do. She tucks it up under her arm like a football, calls her husband at work. He rushes home. She's in the middle of the kitchen, clutching it to her chest. It must be full now, she tells him. It's stopped eating. But even as she says this, the candlesticks on the mantel shoot across the room, impale themselves, and then are gone. She knows nothing but a rising exhilaration. She feels it humming again. It sounds like household appliances, the refrigerator, the blow dryer, the microwave oven, like her husband's razor in the morning. It sounds like everything humming in the house, like everything rocking and shaking and jangling, everything in the universe humming in unison. It vibrates in her arms like a thundercloud, like a rocket ship. When she can no longer hold it, she throws it to the floor, herself on top of it, her husband gaping at her in the doorway. She feels it restless under her like an earthquake, and then the house comes apart. The sofa and the stereo, the washing machine and the bed, the roof and the floor joists all lose their way and are swallowed up. She turns and catches a fleeting look of mismanagement on her husband's face, and then he is gone. Everything is gone, and there is no spare. The treasure beneath her now is a speck, inconsequential in size as a dust mote floating in the streaming sunlight. When it is finished and the humming is a tune, a song alive in her, all that is left, she rises and holds it in the palm of her hand.
Job's angel. Job's angel finds eternity a long tree to suffer. His dog's belly can devour only so much dirt before the anger lingers, stiff as corduroy, hot as velvet. He makes his home in a brilliant night blaze, refuses to die, finds the rotting goat flesh amazing. When I awaken, his only remains are a piece of cake or a fresh morning pie. And what does he know? This is called Training for the Marathon. Tonight, in preparation for the half marathon I will run in 3 weeks, I ran a hard 6 miles. I feel good and tired, ready to hum, to unroll my limbs and drink honey-laced tea. As I wander about my small house in my underwear after a shower, I hear the click, click, click of some disturbance at my front door. My daughter rushes to the window to see my former boyfriend, the man I've called the police on 6 times already. They finally caught him last time, so he's careful to stand 6 inches away from my property line when he lances those rocks from the street and demands to talk to me just one last time. I call to him from my porch that I will not speak. My eyes swarm with the image of my boss at work who laces his arm around me snug and friendly as the calves he lassos back home, and I smile to make sure I don't jeopardize the promotion I'm up for soon. Who knows, I might just get that bonus parking spot in the garage next month. I finally give him 5 minutes. The neighbor who wants a hug from me after his mother died, and yet another, he begs with his quick, sweet smile. Thank you for being so understanding, and I long to be embraced by some wrinkled hag who knows I hate it that men just want me because I'm sweet and I'm pretty. And how do you make the pain go away when you wanted a baby, and who are you kissing this time? I avow I will not speak. I turn and walk into my house to scrub the floor and dial 911. Clearing the grime from my linoleum is easier this time. My legs are buzzing and my daughter wants to watch out the window to see the action, she says. My sick fingers still fidget when the police finally come, 3 this time, and ask me for his name and date of birth, my name and date of birth, and what happened. Stop winking, I want to say. My name is not kiddo, and just because I don't smile at you doesn't mean you should tell me jokes just so I'll laugh. No threats, I say. Only accusations, the same old stuff. I graciously receive the green victim advocate card from the black-clad man with white stripes on his sleeves and add it to my pile of 6 next to the phone, wanting to weep for the first time at how I used to itch to tell the victim's story. But now I turn back and see the Billie Holiday postcard image on my bookshelf and cry that my sex so stings me. Nephi's wife. He confides in his brother Jacob that he wets his pillow at night with his tears for his people. Will he yet shed one tear for me, a nameless woman, in a book of men's wars and wills? I'll just make a little comment about this one. It's called Automatic Caution Door, and I wish I had a visual that I could put on a transparency or something. You know, when you go into a grocery store or some sort of store and they've got automatic doors, and automatic is in the middle and it's really big and that's the word you're supposed to read first? No, it's caution. You're supposed to read caution first. But I always want to read it from the top down. And it finally came to me when I was, when the Southern Baptists were in town. I took my daughter to Liberty Park and had an interesting encounter with a couple of, I don't know what they would call themselves, evangelists or something. A couple of Southern Baptists who came to spread the word. So that's how this came together for me. It's called Automatic Caution Door. The word in the center is meant as the beginning, but I read from top to bottom. The word of warning on the glass doors of the superstore seems too large, unnatural, untraditional. Toward dusk near the chlorinated rivulets meant to simulate the great canyons and waters of the nearby mountains, 2 men approach, Bible in hand, offer a ticket for free pizza at the Southern Baptist Church Wednesday night. The pamphlets they hand me talk of peace with God, why Mormons are not Christians, the Mormon puzzle. Hair parted straight down the middle, the older man is youth pastor of a small congregation in Roy. His ward, the young man, sits on the park bench beside me, witnesses with his story, his father on drugs, in prison, then saved, himself on drugs, caught, then saved, his girlfriend, no sex, she saves. I want to cry, I wish I could tell my own story so boldly, bad love, female rage. But my words begin at the beginning. My gods were once in pain, my prophet full of passion, my internal world a door that does not read caution. My salvation, not such an automatic thing. A modest wish. I wouldn't want to marry an anthropologist or a psychologist, a professor or an analyst who weighed my every word, my every act, until the beads I wear about my neck grew heavy and hard. I'd rather have a poet as a friend who would show me the smoothness of a fish, open her own worlds behind my words, lift a lighted skull on a fir branch high above our heads, and like to talk about the weather. these next few are inspired by a relationship I've had for the last year. And it makes me kind of uncomfortable to call it love poetry, but I guess that's kind of what it is. You are less like a wild universe, a cold ocean, a naked question, more like a slow breath, moist and deep. And a second one, doesn't have a title. You are the eye of youth, the egg of promise, the holy orb of glass that cracks or flowers upon your face as you bow before the ground, fall through a cloud, waving a heel at a teacher, my pupil, in a pin of gray time, the light of my iris. This is also entitled, embrace the naked cup of your longing, caress the glass hand of your caring, sail the young prisoner in and out of every yesterday, slow to see your own face, a smiling animal woman. And I'm going to end with this one called Millenary Grace. It seems he saved her, the amber-skinned island woman who knelt before a prophet, his veined hand skimming her round profile in blessing. Her five children in need of her to spin their marrow in grains and sugar cane, to weave their morning prayers throughout her day. A grand shawl, seams stitched up and down rows of golden pineapple fields and the pews of her new religion. 22 years later, the healing remains in her bones as I collapse through my day, its rigid contours burrowing me through tunnels without hands. Will he save me when all I own is the hem of my child's life? With a patient eye, the needle of my single maternal instinct pulls itself through the thorny rose bushes, late blooming of this hospital garden. The light gray stone of Mary with her babe, a rose in the desert of every day, smooths the grass trimmed fine between the hedges, but finer at the edges. My edge blooms and sighs.
Sunday Ghazals. This ghazal, I should explain this probably. It's a Middle Eastern form, poetic form. It's written in couplets, has a refrain phrase at the end of the lines in each of the couplets. So, Sunday Ghazals. I tell you, I will risk heartbreak to have you. I will risk even your broken heart to have you. The seraph touched a prophet's mouth with a fatal coal, and the angels on children's graves dream of having you. The sun porch opens without screens to the world, the flying things, wasps and dragonflies all long to have you. The shadows of the pine, sweet darkness and pine gum, and you move into the sun where the light will have you. I said, how long? And the grass spoke, and the sap surged, and weather blurred the stones in the cemetery, which soon enough will have you. In my soft dress, I stand at your step and ring the old bell. And though no one comes yet, I know the green morning has you. Edging closer to an unspoken wonder, you smoke in the sun and still, head and heart strong. In dark desire, I will have you. I'll have you. poem's called Lessons. It reminds me, the title of it, I guess, comes from the fact that when you come from a culture that exhorts, you are always supposed to be learning lessons, and so this is my poem of lessons. The word seasons implies a gathering, a seizing of the momentary, the unnoticed, and the setting of them to blaze. This world is poor as it falls and fades in the chill of time, but then it ignites in the bright moment of the eye. The long road lined with stem after stem of wild sunflowers, black eyes and ochre petals, teaching change and brilliance. Afternoons, the bees, lazy with lateness, wondering at windows. The silk of an inner forearm visible at the lifting of a fork over a plate of Chinese vegetables and rice. The seamless hours and hours going by with no mark save the turning of our bodies one to the other. The moon burgeoning with light at month's end. The dark house lined with corridors of moonlight. The moth's soft wings hovering at my ear. These details collect and then collude, gather to teach me something. That it escapes me in the audible rush of time does not undo my learning. This poem is called The Way of the Light, and there's some bagpipes in this poem. I'm going to explain where the bagpipes come from. Actually, I teach here at this college, and for some reason, sort of an odd thing, at ceremonial occasions like convocation and graduation, we have bagpipes. I don't know why. That they're beautiful. So one night I was here before convocation. I could hear them practicing out here on the lawn. Couldn't see them, but I could hear them. So that's where they came from. Here's the rest of the poem. The Way of the Light. In the night before things happen, when the pipers have just finished their mournful practice out on the lawn, with the final notes sounding here or there in the cooling air, the warmer light cast by the high lamps turns a little blue as it drifts down to the grass where the long melodies are threading their way back into the ground. It will not be long before the water rises, undulant, nebulae of spray, the brief flowers gathering and falling in the steadily falling light. The street is wet with whirling rain, shining in shallow pools. Earlier, the light of afternoon sifting in through windows differed in kind, though I am given to it just the same. The body is a kind of landscape, having a topography touched the way the land is by sun, arcing its way through a stippling sky. Lying on the bed, unclothed in the last heat of summer, and the sun catching skin on fire, as in a landscape it ignites the canals or the clouds or the Lombardy poplars. And in throwing up a coverlet to straighten it, the light blooms in a cloud of dust motes. The light is the agent of exile, where I am so close to my own skin, I am almost in it. Still knowing it for the alien land it always has been. Once having observed its ways, I am forever taken. The light drives me always away from the dark home, and circulates in water and dust, perpetual blaze, where lingers a luminous plain chant of praise. Okay, this one's too much like that one, so I'll read it later. This one's called, I've got a whole series of poems with Latin titles. This is the only one I'm going to read today. It's called Ave Verum Corpus, which means Hail, True Body. It's part of the Catholic Mass, speaking of the body of Christ. This is what I want to understand, this, contemplate, drinking bitterness and sweetness nonetheless in the midst, a branch of almond breaking into flower and leaf, remembering now the mystery of incarnation, the God entering a body. As I let him take me, let him lift me up, let him consume me, satisfy for those hours his longing at my body. Let light fall there and then the dark. Let his smoke fill my mouth and hair. Let him be the God for me. I learnt the true God, true body at his hands. Behold, the Christ lifted up and lain down, and tenderly washed by a woman's hair, with green oils anointed in their ripe perfumes, rosemary and cloves, folded into his winding sheets, and upon rising, discovering his absence again and again in the centuries, the callas waiting as if to hear once more his call, a saving grief, the life in a world going on, with and without him. This is a poem called The Limit. It's a poem explicitly about the body and the meaning that the term the body seemed to take for me in repeated ways in my poetry and my life, my thinking. So it's called The Limit. This poem takes place at the West Jordan pool. It is the afternoon after. At the pool, the shrieks of children and the glissandi of water lifting and falling hang in the air, circulating through the grass and over bare skin. It is the long afternoon of the body's meditation. The clouds pass before the sun, an intermittent diminishing of the light, its waning fury. I soak up heat and light. I soak up the drifting of the clouds. I take in the pattern of the breeze sweeping the sweat off my skin. If only it were something less personal, more abstract, the me in this afternoon, then I'd know what to make of all this, and not merely wish for the last of summer sun to burn away what's breaking loose inside. Then I wouldn't say, in an effort at dispassion, this is something resembling heartbreak. I'd know how to read the language of the birds crossing my path. For the last 3 days they've come near, two hummingbirds, little fawn-colored wings, the throbbing hufferers, one in the canyon, another by the stream, and then a blue jay swooping and diving across the road. A dark vengeance. They might be the vowels and consonants to speak the single word, just to complete this one sentence. A way, I think it could be, though it might be a word so blunt as flight. I am in the body, and have let such movements as the flight of birds come near me, till the wings might brush my skin. The body, I say it as if it were some new savior, a new thing to call the truth, some new thing to break myself against, some new thing from which to learn the hard lesson of limits. The good or ill the body deals to take me to the end of everything, spent, though still full of longing. What takes me there then says, here and no further. In that vein, my son is a diabetic, and I wrote this poem just after he was diagnosed, called My Son on the Altar. After all the loving gods have closed the sky and the night has settled in, and I am driving home from the hospital where he is, where he lies, where his veins swim in the water he's lost, and he sleeps until they wake him for more of his blood. After this, the dark god, the one whose name is on the altar, the one who demands a sacrifice, broken hearts, contrition, that god of this world has seized my heart in a cold grip and has said to me, "You believed that you could have whatever it was you wanted. You believed like a fool in the inhabited moment and in the full days and nights of desire. You believed, and what you believed will be your doom." He has said to me, "Believe what you will, but know the law, that for every moment you lived in, for every day and night that you filled with the urge, with longing, it will be one moment of pain for those you have loved. Tonight it will be your blonde boy on the altar," he has said to me. "You've stopped listening to the voice of justice. You've been a thief in my house, and you will pay. But," he has said to me, "not from your own pocket. Take the coin from the boy." Two more or one more? Okay, I have one longish and one shortish. I'll do that. Okay. This one is called Sowing and Reaping. I am a borrowed solitude lying on a quilt where the sun comes in through an open window in the late afternoon. My eyes are closed and I'm trying to absorb pure heat, save it up against colder times. The dust of domesticity shimmers, remote and apart, and I lift my hand into a glove of brightness. The breeze in the trees outside makes a brief stir. The panes are woven with webs made by spiders who spin nothing but light. The slight breath of the wind makes them arc, curve, plain geometries of a spark. Another might clean these windows, but the webs and the dust shall remain. It is one way of loving the light. A plurality of birds has gathered here, and their movements are instructive as they fly into and out of a window's frame. One dark bird's wings, edged with the sun, stayed open, its breast holding my eye and my breath. It moved as slowly and as high as cloud drift. I couldn't know that the currents of air moving around us would hold it. It could not come closer to me, though I wished it would and hoped it would not. At that height, it hovered in the frame for the longest moment, riding its own darkness, gathering all the blue at the center of heaven to itself, till the eye of the world could see only this single shadow, its slow planing in the dome of the sky. I have only loved the wind for its invisible way, for its ghost in the wings of birds, for its whisper seizing the light and setting the world to burn. The wind takes my soul, and what I know from that turns light into bright rain, sets a darkening fire in the hills. This last one is called Becoming the Venus. Some of you probably, most of you probably seen at least a picture of that little statue called, they call the Venus of Willendorf. That's the Venus I'm talking about. Becoming the Venus. You will know me with the blue lapis icon suspended between my breasts, or wearing black, lining my eyes with coal, or making my lips up like a noir princess, as a woman of this world, this century, this calendar year. Even so, you will call me eternal, because you like the way my breasts feel heavy in your hands, the way my belly softens under your urge. And when I sleep, my body darkens. In my own dreams, I thicken. I am more and more flesh. I am becoming my own clay, magma within my hips, an old lost language within my belly, red flesh. When you emerge from the cave of your own dreams, I will be there, generating worlds. Thank you.
In sleep. Yes, she slept with him, but did she sleep with him? She says she banged him, bawled him, overhauled his engine of desire, and held his ankles to the flame. But did she sleep with him? Put out the fire, let go of consciousness, and keep the vigil with the dead? I think she left him lifeless, like a corpse, wrapped in his bedclothes, blank face turned toward the wall. In some dank cafe, she drank coffee, smoked a cigarette until it burned her fingers, waited for the red of dawn, and now she's gone. Had she been in my bed, I would have slept with her, enfolded her in gown of night, and held her body in a long continuum of dream. Dream that, broken open in the light, would split the seam of shadow. That animus we yearn for is not the act or acts of love, but spaces in between. In sleep, in dream, in rude exchange of breath, in secret turnings in the night, is found the deep. Sleep with me. Inscrutable companion, twin blacks. Let's start that again. Twin black tracks that cut the corners of your eyes, lined in beige, make it appear that when you blink, you're tearing ink. Your inquisitive, patient stare, is it expectation or resignation to some loss that cannot be expressed? As I eat, you sit next to me at the empty place, Egyptian in your stillness. Since I have not invited you to table, you claim it as your prerogative. Your rapt gaze plays with my food, but you do not lift a claw until I'm done. White of nose, chin, throat, descends to snowfield chest and belly. Spine is black. Elegant markings define your sides. Dark parentheses, dots and dashes, circular bands on a field of gray, Rorschach blot on left rear shank, rayfish ringtail. While I bathe, you levitate to the basin to sip from the dripping tap. Whiskers grow from symmetrical rows of dark furrows in gray-orange fur. Your ears burrows where a hoarfrost of delicate hair filters each swish I make with my toe. Short night of summer. After the long postlude, when her fingers leave the organ keys, voice from a rear pew says, "One more time." But we triangulate, she, her lover, me, in a front pew. "You are the day," she tells me, knee visible in dark skirt. "I'll be the night," her lover says. But she is night. the shortest night of summer, and must meet her brother at the city building for gay pride. Just yesterday, her mother cut her bridal dress, white raw silk stretched on breakfast bar. But here in church, in this cool space, where I first saw her splendid face, she will be wed. Jesus Lost. Do you know this picture? Asks the magazine. Yes, I've seen this man before. I'm sure that clean bronze brow, those dark eyes, intensity, surprised me in the sterile whiteness of junior Sunday school. Solomon's Jesus had both the sorrow and the sensuality of the sinner and the passion of saving grace. He's the Jesus of our childhood, but he's lost now. They're looking for him, the advertisement says, asking if we remember where he hung, at home, in or school, or church, and if still, sometimes at night, he lurches in our hearts. The Jesus on Channel 3 has red hair and a cocked eyebrow. He is sad and sardonic, and I like it when he shares the screen with Dragon Lady, who wears a huge hive of dark hair with a lightning streak and a face so soft the lines in it look like rivers. Solomon's Jesus is masculine in a way that's not yet in style. His smile's so deep it is internal. You can only see it in his eyes. This is not ascetic Jesus. He won't please our self-denial. He's a thinker and a feeler who requires intimacy as his first and only commandment. Why is Jesus lost? They didn't ask that question on Good Friday or the day of Pentecost. But in the latter days, we just don't know. We cannot seem to find him. Once saw his name and image on a poster, wanted for anarchy, sedition, vagrancy, and conspiracy to overthrow. I looked for Jesus in the faces of the children in a sixth grade class. From Mars. On the red planet, our war machines are raising dust. What if some speck of us is seen in the long lens of a Venus telescope? Between us and that female face behind the glass are light years. At this distance, no way could we cop a feel, let alone copulate. Yet I have a feeling. Oops, feeling is forbidden on this planet, isn't it? I have a feeling we could talk. Would it be shocking if we had something to say to each other in the same solar system? I would say, I'm lonely here. Our years are so much longer, and our planet's diurnal rotation allows 24 hours, 37 minutes to think of you. Brilliant Venus winking on the cusp of our supernal vision, illuminate our war rooms, amplify our dreams, stir the iron oxide in the pigment of our blood that rusts to powder in our veins. With your clear gaze, if you should scope our stain, beam us female brainwaves. In the bars of Mars, we drink to find what's missing in ourselves. And are you missing something, too? That speck that irritates your eye, don't Don't wipe the lens. Magnify the residue. Well, I'm going to read once more, and then one more, and then I'm going to suggest we'll have 10 minutes left. That I think the first two of us sort of truncated what was going to be read because we thought we weren't going to have enough time. I think we have room at least for another half round and maybe more. I'm not sure I want to read this one. I don't know what I want to read. Yeah, well, this is the one I'm not supposed to read, but so I'm going to read it. Sons of bitches. Why do these sons feel defined by their mothers? Whine about the feminine glitches in their masculine facades, itch for females, but won't recognize anything tender under their own skins. Bitch at their sons because their spirits aren't yet pounded flat like hammered tin. Dog their own mothers. Tag them with names they claim are inherently female. Pussy. Bitch. Hoe. Slut. Then in the throes of some ongoing separation anxiety, tell you their nuts are the courage of their convictions. A woman I knew once described herself as titsy. I knew what she was trying to do and I approved of it, but it didn't quite work. It was in response to a series of jerks who screwed up their bravery with their genitals. Ballsy, they called themselves, never nutsy, she noticed. Just how gutsy would she have to get to tell these pricks to fuck off? But I don't think she ever did. Is it someplace in the id that masculinity gets mangled? Entangled threads of terror and desire, men screw it up? It's nobody's business but our own, but it's a bad business. We'd like to find a few witches to burn, a few girl goats to scape. That would make us feel better. But these sons of bitches, never learn. Well, I'd like to ask, Terry, would you like to read your other short?
Not really.
that's very direct. She doesn't want to. Yeah. Lorraine, you've got a few more. How about it?
Okay, well, this is a weird one. Here it is. It's called Growing Up on Bear Street, and it's got an interesting history to it. Briefly, I sent it into a journal to be published, and they accepted it for publication, but they wrote back a letter and said that in order for them to accept it for publication, I had to self-describe as a lesbian. And I had a little battle with that, so did my husband, and decided not to to do that. And they wrote back about a year later and said they changed their mind and they'd let Sexual Woman publish in their journal. So it's called Growing Up on Bayer Street. Mama doesn't talk. Ivory pebbles fall from her eyes. Papa in the kitchen fumes the air with rage like madness from a can, canned rage exploding wild and loose over the floor, then rising a cloud of hot air, red-hot anger, staining the walls and the ceiling like the horizon on Resurrection Day, both magnificent and unbearable. I carry the love of God in my belly. It's what he said. For the love of God, hold still. Hold still. Hold still. Still, I don't know how it happened. A shortcut home, cut short, nearly home. On Bayer Street, he halts me with a gun and a grin, a smile toothy as a set of old dentures, his shoulders brazen like a bulldozer, his soul like a black widow spider, poisonous, small, spinning a web of confusion, pain and torment is tight. His eyes rimmed red from the lack of something, red like a blaze, like a siren, warning, beware, be where he can't get you, find you, take you. But I am here, and he is here, and this is all I know. He has traveled a long way. He carries the stench of all those other places on his breath, in his skin, in the very hidden cells of his body. His rage opens me under a sheltered gray sky. He's cold as cold and solid, unyielding as concrete, his body in mine in the night, tearing, exposing, claiming, push coming to shove all over the place. Escalation as black as pain, as purple as death, no roaring like a wave in my pale bones, pulsing pink between my shaking legs. Silent as a prayer, that tossed penny, the wish in the water tumbling in the green. Thunder in the distance claps me awake again, and the barking dog bids me home, but I can't move. The night is halfway gone before they find me lying in a puddle of glass and misuse. They carry me home through the rain, a parade of mourners trailing something lost. I tell what he did in the language I have never spoken, but this I do not tell. When he was finished with me, taunting, he asked me, laughing, taunting me, he said, would you like to hold the gun? I stared at him. I saw him then. I pushed my sweater down. I closed my legs. I told him no. Later, Papa says, if only you'd had a chance to get your hands on that gun. Or me, he says. What's taken from me is transparent as air. The wound he leaves inside of me, though, grows huge. A cannonball of trouble. My brother, the priest, my life and family clothed in the sacred robes of the church tell me all life is sacred. Possibilities are measured by degrees of sin. Whispers hide around the corner when I am nearby. A net is cast, a solution gathered. Mama's married sister with a barren womb, arms as wide as the ocean, a heart as tender as heaven, they say. The day wriggles free of the night in its own time, wet as mud, soft as silk, cradled in cotton and blood. I hold her a while, then she is gone. The wind carries her across the sky, away from me, away to Philadelphia, to parts unknown, to an aunt as foreign to me as the sea. For months after, I dream that gun into my hands. I point that gun at him, that man. I pull that trigger. I shoot him dead. Then in my dream, the people come, my people, his people. They see him dead and nod as if they understand. Put the gun down now, they say. It is safe. You have made it safe. You can put the gun down. I try. Papa comes and brushes light into my eyes and grasps that gun that will not let go. Forever afterwards, I carry that gun with me like a finger, a tooth, a lung, my appendage. I run the barrel down the curving spine of my sleeping lover, across the cleft of a newborn's chin. I garden with a gun, grow peonies and daylilies and daffodils. People run from me in grocery stores. I cannot board a plane. The neighbors can only nod and smile and pat. Papa rakes his fingers through his gray streaked beard. Mama wrings her hands, more rhyme than reason. I stare out the kitchen window at the moon glowing cheesy and full. I sit on the hard stool on a pillow, legs bent, back pressed against the yellow wall, a little tender, leaking, living in the body of things I don't recognize anymore.
Find a couple more here. Genetics. What fatal flaw awaits the child blooming in my womb? And why, like an artichoke heart open to the tongue only once the fat, fibrous petals are consumed, must I shed one horny husk at a time with my cracked promises before I snap the synapse, call it uncongenital, and leap before the soothing tomb? Educated woman. An educated woman wouldn't sleep in her clothes. Wouldn't I, a Harley man, forget to pay the water bill, pick up her daughter at the wrong school, neglect her rose bush, eat chocolate cake for breakfast, feed a mad stray dog, wonder if she'll be homeless in a year? An educated woman would take the garbage out each Wednesday morning, Tuesday night on a good day. An educated woman would sing each Sunday hymn in a well-modulated voice, fill the gas tank when half full, arrange for a babysitter a week in advance, attend the charity ball, and carefully wipe her fingers of the cheese cracker residue on a linen napkin, paper if necessary. When I read this one, second grade play. Second grade play was the sideshow to our womanhood. In the beginning, I wore my new green and navy plaid dress, and when the bus dropped me off early, I sat reverently on the low hill of the school grounds, pulling up my knee socks as far over my legs with the fine dark hair as they would go, clamping my knobs tightly together and contemplating the peaceful green and bright blue of the landscape. Then, when the two chosen sixth graders came along to draw the flag up its pole, that peace welled up and out my eyes and pulled my hand to my heart like the string on a puppet. On fine cold days we played kissing tag with the boys, who always missed us, as we barely made our way to the safety of cool cement steps at the side door of the school, although I technically was caught by Noel one time, the small brown boy whose parents smoked and whom I liked or felt sorry for, I wasn't sure which, but never wanted to encourage, not really. And as our play days continued through spring with summer's bright lemon and green promise, we wanted to tend a legacy. The dandelion proofs caught our fancy, and we got it in our heads to plant the entire school yard. Not knowing they were weeds, we plucked the fine seeds from the yellow and white heads clumped together and staked our claims, spending entire recesses for weeks sitting on our nests to better push the seeds into the ground so they would flourish. All this prepared me for the time that I should sit in the crotch of this mountain, my hair blowing free above the clouds, the wind from airplanes barely grazing my neck as I survey the land around, crouching on my haunches, my toes digging into the uncultivated earth to pack down the poppies and corn and to winnow the rose. At dawn's breaking, the sliver of moon at my waking grazes my brow like God's fingernails and pours a drop of oil that runs from my cheek. Lightning strikes my foot and leaves three black specks on the sole.
Yeah.